question of the conditions which are necessary in order that each one of us could be a source of benediction to the world is a very deep question indeed. It is another way of discovering what is our individual destiny and how one may fulfill it. And the discovery cannot be in positive terms. We cannot positively say, my destiny is so and so, so and so, so and so. It can only be in terms of realizing what should be absent in order that this state of being a benediction to the world may hold good. You see, consider for a few moments our planet, the Earth. We think of it and we are aware of it simply as matter, one planet belonging to a solar system. We think of it in terms of solid, liquid, gaseous. There's air around it. Things grow upon it. There are animals in it and there are human beings in it. That is how we think. That is how we are conscious of the planet Earth. And we are conscious of ourselves as something separate from this planet. We are humans. We have dominion over the earth. We believe it is our right to dominate the earth, which is quite different from having dominion. To dominate is to oppress and to exploit. To hold dominion, lordship, means to nurture, to serve, which is something quite different. But we think of ourselves as lords of the earth in the wrong way. We are the robbers of the earth. But now, let us see that it is this earth which has brought us into being. For convenience, we'll confine ourselves to earth. Actually, earth, sun, the whole universe is involved in our existence. I exist because there is the universe. It was before I was. It will continue to be after this person called Firoz has ceased to be. And through us, the earth comes to consciousness, to self-consciousness. That is what the earth realizes, what the totality realizes. Through human beings, it realizes self-consciousness. It is not merely you or I who is self-conscious. It is the totality which realizes self-consciousness through us. Now the totality is moving towards something even profounder, insofar as we cooperate with that totality. This is where we do come into the picture. We can say yea or nay to totality in a manner which your animal, your plant, your stone cannot do. Your animal just responds more or less automatically. The power of looking within, of knowing oneself as oneself, of deliberately deciding, I will do thus or thus or thus or thus, belongs only to man. And even that only to a slight extent, not to a very great extent. But that slight extent is the seed out of which can emerge a vision which ultimately releases man into his true godliness, into his godhood, which is his true manhood. The word God stands in reality, in actuality, for the perfected, holy man. Now, if we begin to be really aware that there is this growth taking place, this flowering out towards the recognition that we are part and parcel of that totality, that totality is immensely greater and more wonderful than we are. But we are the only medium through which totality can bring out this profounder depth of mind, of consciousness. There is an evolution of consciousness, an emergence of something of which we can have no conception at the moment. When a mutation takes place, it is not possible to predict beforehand what the mutation will be. It is something quite unique, something which we cannot calculate. And we cannot calculate for the very simple reason that we cannot know in terms of our mental functioning the life process as it works in its own mysterious way. We can't know it. It is beyond thought, beyond logic. This computer brain of ours, as also what we call our insights, our intuitive perceptions, or what you will, none of them can really picture for ourselves here what that emergence will be. Because that emergence will be associated with a functioning as much beyond us as we are now, as we are beyond a stone, say. We have thought, imagination, and so many other remarkable faculties which the stone, presumably anyway, has not got. But our thought and our imagination and our intuitive perceptions and so forth are all restricted. They are all held in, they are bound. Bound by the limitations which are inherent in our own psychophysical organism. This organism being what it is, thus far can we go. But the thus far that we can go is far enough. The perfected Holy One is something quite extraordinary, and that's as far as we can go. But beyond that is something deeper, profounder, greater, quite unimaginable, quite unpredictable. But this is the way the primordial energy moves, brought forth a universe. Some mysterious way, electrical energies produced atoms, perhaps hydrogen, the ultimate chemical origin, matter. What we call matter. Perhaps one useful way of understanding matter is to regard it as a constriction, a self-imposed limitation on and by primordial energy. It becomes matter. Then only there is an appearance. Until then there is no appearance. And when these atoms get together closer and closer, when there is sufficient proximity of those atoms, the states of matter which we call gaseous, liquid, and finally solid come into being. And out of them all, gradually, there emerges life, mind, consciousness, self-consciousness with the power of looking within. And then the next great movement outwards, and this is where religion in the grand sense comes in, to see the self, which is here materially in reality, as undivided from the totality. This one can think of, but to think it is not to see it. To see in the profound sense means to be aware of it with such intensity that it has become part and parcel of our nature, the awareness of that truth. And if it has become part and parcel of our nature, our daily life in thought and feeling, speech and action is completely changed. It becomes pure. Then, this person, oneself, the psychophysical being, has become free, totally free, of isolative self-consciousness. It has become harmless. And harmlessness is the state in which one is wholly in tune, in harmony within oneself and with the totality. That is the harmless state. And one becomes harmless completely, all the time, all the 24 hours of the day, one is harmless. Every one of us realizes the harmless state, at least for a little while during the day, in profound slumber, in dreamless slumber, sushupti. One is harmless. One has become completely related to the totality and is free from conflict within oneself, because the stream of words and desire have ceased to operate. They are quiet in profound dreamless slumber. Then one is a source of benediction. But when that happens in sleep, that benediction benefits us ourselves mostly, perhaps almost entirely. We wake up recharged, revitalized. If that state of sushupti is present throughout the 24 hours of the day, in our waking state, in our dreaming state, because for some hours of the day there has to be the dreaming state, and also in the actual sleep state of deep slumber, if it operates for all 24 hours of the day, then one is completely in harmony with the universe, and one is a source of blessing, of benediction to it, because then primordial energy, transcendence if you like, God if you like to use that word, functions through that organism without being resisted by the organism. That person is a pure person. So now, we will see that person is perpetually in the state of communion. Whatsoever he may be doing, he or she may be cooking a meal or sweeping the floor, but the pure, harmless person who is doing that is a focus point of benediction to everyone and everything around all the time. Such a person is utterly calm within the gusts of craving, of passion, of confusion, of anxiety, of fear, do not throw him off balance. This does not mean that his very highly developed sensitivity becomes blind to all the psychical forces that flow through the world. He is aware of them. If there is, for example, mob hysteria sweeping a multitude, He's well aware of it. He feels the thrill of it. He will perhaps shake with it, but he cannot be thrown down by it. Now it is that sort of person that is being used by transcendent energy all the time. That sort of person is in perpetual communion, and this is meditation in the supreme sense. Not just musing, not just moving from one thought to another thought. If you look at the Upanishads, take for instance one of the very interesting Upanishads, because it is so much in line with a good deal of modern psychological knowledge, the Muktikopanishad, the Liberation Upanishad, if you like to translate it into English. Take that. And take the teachings in Tibetan Buddhism too. You will find it stated that if a thought arises, chop it down. It is stated in rather drastic terms. Why? If a feeling arises, if a scheme of operation, a plan arises in the mind, chop it down. Get rid of it. Why is that stated? Take another example. If you go into the Samyutta Nikaya, the kindred sayings as they are called, it's a collection of sayings on any particular topic, then a collection of all the sayings on another topic, and so on. So they are called kindred sayings. If you look at the third volume there, one of the Buddha's great disciples comes to him and says, Lord, they say, a being. Pray, Lord, what is a being? And how far is one a being? And the Buddha answers, that lust, that lure, that craving associated with shape, form, the body, entangled by that, fast entangled by that, to that extent is one called a being. Then he repeats the same thing with respect to the sensations, Vedana, the feelings, and so forth. He repeats that with respect to thoughts, ideas, perceptions. He repeats the same statement with respect to the sankhara, the volitions which move one, the thought patterns which one holds to, and according to which one behaves and makes a pattern of life for himself. And he repeats it with respect to our discriminative consciousness, which functions here, because we are conscious all the time in discriminative terms, terms which analyze, which separate out. This is, of course, necessary, otherwise we couldn't exist physically. We must know that a chair is a chair and a bus is a bus. Otherwise there'd be some confusion. and so forth. Then he goes on to say, you have seen how little children will make sand castles, and as long as they are interested, have the desire for, are dominated by the passion to make sand castles, they will make sand castles. But the moment their desire, their craving for sand castles is over, with hand and foot they knock the sand castles down. So too, O Radha, do you knock down, break up, sweep aside body, feelings, thoughts, perceptions, discriminative consciousness itself. Now, you know, that's a tremendous thing to say. What is he leading up to? As the words stand, we interpret it as, well, it just means the total destruction of the psychophysical organism. That is what it appears to be. But now consider carefully. If one destroyed the body, that is the end of all life. There is no such thing then as the attempt to live the religious life. There is no possibility of any one of us then being a source of benediction to anybody, and so forth. What is this shape? Rupa is shape, literally. It is usually translated into English as body, which is not incorrect, but it is not the whole thing. Rupa is a shape, a form. And we must always remember, and this is what mankind always forgets, that the great religious teachers were fundamentally concerned with the mind. They were the healers of the mind, the doctors of the mind, which means the teachers of the nature of the mind and its operation. Because it is mind that distinguishes us from sticks and stones and so forth, isn't it? All right, they were that. So now, rupa, shape. Concentrate attention upon shape, form, as far as the mind is concerned. All the time there are thought forms arising. There are desire forms arising in the mind. Any experience that we have cannot be experienced in reality unless there is the mind in operation. If, for instance, you're walking through the street and there is a marvelous sunset taking place, you are ignorant of it because your mind was miles away from that sunset. It is the mind. It might almost be true that if you're sitting on a tin tack and your mind is miles away, you'll never feel it. See? It's the mind, the shape in the mind. All right. What's all the rest about? Our feelings, ideas, perceptions. It's all discriminative consciousness. It's all about the mind, isn't it? Now, this mind which we have, what sort of a mind is it? Is it a pure mind? Or is it a tainted mind? Whenever I see something, hear something, touch something, taste something, smell something, think something, imagine something, is not my discriminative consciousness, which is conscious of this, tainted with my greeds, my fears, my ambitions, my anxieties, my hatreds, my ill will, and my stupidities. Isn't that the fact of my life from moment to moment? This is how I see, taste, touch, hear, smell, impurely, distortedly. And so this mind is a cesspool. It's full of evil things. You know, if you look at Genesis, when the Lord God wants to send the flood, there is a verse there which states that the Lord God saw that the thoughts, he says that because the thoughts in the mind of man, in the heart of man, are nothing but evil. It's very significant, isn't it? So now, this is a fact of our existence, that this is the case. And all our sense perceptions, the use of our senses, and our relationships to all sense objects, which means our total daily life actually, they are all tainted. And towards all of them, we have either a craving for or an aversion against. Now, it is this which the Buddha was talking of when he said to Radha, knock it down, break it up, scatter it, get rid of it all. That is what he meant, surely. Now, where is the origin? What is the source from which this state in which we find ourselves? What is this source from which it emerges? It starts right in our infancy. Right from the very beginning. And it starts not because we, as the newborn infant, deliberately wished it or wanted it that way, but because this physical organism has a pleasure-pain mechanism. If the pleasure-pain mechanism were not there, the organism would not survive. And because I, as the newborn infant and totally ignorant, I cannot avoid building up this desire for the pleasurable through the senses and the aversion to the unpleasurable. This is the origin. So for all the sensations, through sight, taste, touch, sound, whatever it be, you see, all the sensations that give me pleasure, I crave for their repetition. And so craving grows. Now, throughout life, all the impressions through the senses, which are made upon the brain, upon the mind, they are all tainted. And having been made, they all sink into this well of the, let us use the modern term, personal unconscious. They sink into that well. They are not exhausted, their energy is not exhausted, far from it. Their energy is in fact reinforced by the repetition of the pleasurable, because of the drive of craving, and so forth. So this well of the personal unconscious gets filled with evil trash. Because after all, what are the petty little things that we are concerned with throughout our life? It gets filled with evil trash. These are named the vasanas, the mental impressions. That's just a non-moralistic term, you see. The vasanas, the mental impressions. Now these mental impressions just live in our whole being. When we are quiet, as we say, up they jump and claim attention. They clamor, and we are thinking about them. And we are thinking in terms of desire, of pleasure. We are feeling in terms of fear, anxiety, and so on and so on, all the time. So we see what our task of purification is like. Now I know we all want a method to sweep out all the dirt. But the method has been, if one may use that term method, has been told countless times, and it just goes like water off a duck's back. The very next time we talk about it, the same question comes, but how do I do it? One is told the whole truth about it in one simple sentence, in two words, that's all. And one says, oh yes, and that also has sunk into the well of the personal unconscious. Ineffective, inoperative. You know, this is very serious. Man is a lazy boy. He's a procrastinator. He's childish. He just wants to play about, to fool about. He doesn't mean business. And we want to meditate. We want to enter into deep prayer, to give ourselves to the Lord and His works and all the rest of it. We want to become mystics. We want to become perfected holy men. Watch carefully. Listen carefully. We want to. And what is the nature of that wanting? The nature of that wanting is that same grasping, dominating demon that lies wrapped up with all our other thinking, feeling, doing, speaking, and all the rest of it. Do you want the proof of this? Then look. I'm a businessman, say. I run a big business. Our turnover is such, our profits are such, I have such and such a home. There is my wife. There are my children, there are my dependents, my friends. I have to maintain this kind of way of life and this status. All my status symbols have to be kept up, otherwise my business will go down, which of course is the fact. Now, let me look at those status symbols. Let me look at this way of life which has to be kept up. The mink coats for the director's wife and or wives, as the case may be. The luncheon parties, the dinner parties, and all the rest of it. The very skillful game of chess, you know, getting a word, a sentence out of him, putting a thought into the other fellow's mind. Oh, the business grows, business is booming, and so forth. And at the same time, I want to be the perfected holy one. I want to be the mystic. I want to be the servant of God. Now, we must see that in this dualistic sphere, whose essential characteristic is conflict, there are opposites, there are duals which are totally irreconcilable. And there are duals which are complementaries also. The complementaries present no problem to us. It's the irreconcilables which present the problem. What do I do then? There is no question about it. If religion means anything to me, if I'm really gone on religion, absolutely mad on it, you see, just naturally mad, which is an extremely healthy madness, you see, if that is the case, I get out of this business. Yes, of course, I have to sell up my house, my cars, and this and that, and the Costa Bravas and the whatever they may be. Of course. Recall what you did. What marvelous, self-sacrificial, heroic feats we performed in the golden days when we were madly in love. What did we not do for the beloved? We were prepared to jump over the moon. The cow jumped over the moon, and the dish ran away with the spoon. All sorts of wonderful things like that can happen when one is really in love. Am I really in love with religion, with transcendence? No. Now you see, we have considered this thing over and over again because it is so fundamental. There is no sense in wanting disciplines and undertaking disciplines, or wanting to go through a system or a course or a technique of meditation and this, that and the other. We want the meditation in the same way, qualitatively, as we want 5 bottles of whiskey a day. Or cannabis, or whatever it may be. It's a drug, it's a destructive thing in a different sphere, that is all. Now look. I'm using my own book because it's got a nice summary of it, whereas the actual text in the long discourses of the Buddha is very long-winded. It takes about 4 pages. Now, this is in the long discourse known as the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. Sutta means discourse, Maha means big, and Sati means mindfulness. There's your key word. How do I do it all? Pay attention, be mindful. There is nothing else to be told. That's the whole technique. Be mindful. Now, this is what the Buddha says in detail. And summarized, it is like this. The coming to be of ill, misery, sorrow, pain, destruction, evil, is due to craving, accompanied by lust and self-indulgence. Note carefully, seeking satisfaction, now here, now there, to wit, the craving for the life of sense, for becoming, that is, becoming this or that or the other, the company director or the man who jumps the biggest height or and so on and so on, personal achievement, for becoming and also for de-becoming. Some translate it as ending existence, or some would translate it as super-becoming. Vibhava tanha. I rather favor the idea of super-becoming, because, you see, a person who is interested in religion at all gives up wanting to become an oil magnate or something like that. Instead, he wants to become a magnate in the spiritual sense, you see. Oh, to become a super mystic or possessed of wonderful psychic powers or this, that, and the other. And actually, the prefix V, where Sanskrit is concerned, generally means, it gives emphasis to the thing rather than states the opposite. In Pali, they say that very frequently it's the negation of the thing which is meant. However, this is the craving for the life of sense, for becoming, for super-becoming. Craving arises out of the senses, including imagination, out of the objects of sense, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, intentions, memories, preoccupation, and deliberation arising out of the use of the senses and objects of sense. The Buddha says out of the use of the senses. I think it would be more accurate to have said out of the misuse of the senses. Because the fact remains that it is totally impossible to exist at all without using your senses properly and rightly. And the Buddhist discipline certainly teaches us how to use our senses rightly and properly. In fact, to sharpen our senses and to develop them so far that we are all there, in fact. You are really properly trained. Buddhist bhikkhu, for example, he is all there. Where I might just suddenly stumble over the pavement, your bhikkhu won't. He'll have observed. He'll have trained his sense of sight. You see, and so forth. So, it's the misuse of the senses and the objects of sense. The cessation of ill is brought about by the utter cessation of and disenchantment about that very craving, giving it up, renouncing it, emancipation from it, detachment from it, by putting away material things. Note what he says, putting away material things, the use of the senses, I would again say the misuse of the senses, the objects of sense, and by putting away thoughts, stimuli, feelings, perceptions, intentions, memories, preoccupation, and deliberation arising out of the senses and the objects of sense. Now you see, this is a tremendous statement, isn't it? And a man of the world reading this would say, but good gracious, this means the complete denial of human life as it is ordinarily lived. Of course it means that. Very definitely it means that. It does not mean that we cease to live in the world. But it does mean that we cease to live as being of the world, worldly. And remember, this is the starting point. This is kindergarten work. Kindergarten work. This is what we must do. I know, so many immediately ask, but how do I do it? Well, look. Have you taken your own little child along on the pavement, little toddler? Or seen somebody take a little child along on the pavement, and you come to a nice little puddle? What does the little fellow do? Plonk! He's happy, both feet in. He enjoys it. He does it. Did he ask you how to do it? You give the little fellow a chocolate or a nice cake. Does he ask you, how do I eat? He jolly well does it. The urge is there, the drive is there. The technique is at hand. We can learn a lot by looking at babies. Far more than we learn from most of the clever fellows of the world. So now, how do I do all this? If I care for it, I will easily do it, won't I? How do you refrain from smoking, drinking, and all the rest of it? If you're absolutely keen on rowing in that boat race next week, you jolly well do it, don't you? You don't ask the other fellow, look here, how do I stop smoking? You just do it. In the doing, we shall experience the conflict. I'd like to, but no, I must not because... But if I really care, it will not be because, but because I care. But simply the care being there, I naturally do not do this, that, and the other. I refrain from it. This natural abstinence is purity. Not the abstinence which is tied up with perpetual conflict. You know, this is an enormous statement. Putting away thoughts, stimuli, feelings, perceptions, intentions, memories, preoccupation and deliberation arising out of the senses and sense objects. Look at all the preoccupation of mind and the deliberation of mind which we go through throughout the day. It's entirely tied up with sense objects. Now, don't ask me questions like this. Does that mean, therefore, that I do not think about my potatoes and so on, which I have to cook? Well, the answer is just be sensible and ask sensible questions of yourself. But apply it in life and see what happens. Do you know? Happiness will bubble out. Because you will not be plagued and cursed with the way of life of the world, although living in the world. The argument comes up, but if I apply this to my business life and my business breaks down, I shall be reduced to beggary. Yes, I might be. What is it that I care for? The pennies or the fruition of life? Is it the pennies I care for or that my blindness shall be healed and my eyes shall be opened to the truth so that the reality will come to fruition? I shall die. Never forget that. Maybe now, tomorrow, maybe 10 years hence. I shall die. The totality will go on. I can only say yea or nay to the totality. And if I say nay, I shall be a sinner. That is, one who has divided himself from the totality. And that is the basic meaning of sin. I shall be a sinner, and unto me will absolutely and inevitably come the wages of sin, death. Death, the destroyer, the disruptor. That ineluctable and invincible power, which will merely cast me on the rubbish heap afterwards. Because I had said nay to life and the truth. But if I say yea to life and the truth, then death comes as the consummator, as the finisher, the divine craftsman who now takes this back into the totality with no stain. Nothing against his name. Look, if you like, think of this in connection with the book of Revelation. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact chapter and verses, but there's that passage where his name will be written on a stone or something like that comes in. Look, pull out that this red. No, not the book. This thing underneath. The manuscript. Look. No, which is lying flat.
Oh, yes.
I'll read it for you straight away. Here we are. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. The paradise of God, or the Garden of Eden, whichever way you like to look at it, is this organism here. This living person is the paradise of God, is the Garden of Eden. In this garden, there is planted the tree, the spinal column and the brain. And the brain is the root, and it is an upside-down tree. See? This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and it is also the tree of life. They are the self-same tree. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving him that receiveth it. The name I bear now is Mortal Man. And the name that is written in that stone is Immortal God. It's Revelation chapter 3, verses 5 and 12, and also Revelation chapter 2, 7, 11 and 17. You look it up, Revelation chapters 2 and 3. So now, if one goes through this real metanoia, this real conversion, in the world, but not of the world. In the world, maybe in a monastery also, or a retreat, or in a cave, or on the heights of a mountain. Because your monastery, your retreat, your cave, your mountain are on Mother Earth. You're in the world. You can go out into outer space if you like. But you are in the cosmos. You cannot be thrown out of the cosmos. In the world, but not of the world. And this is where our conflict comes. We live in the world and we compromise. And we are partly of the world, rather a large part, almost up to the eyes. And only the rest tries to be not of the world. That is to say, it indulges in the intellectual delight of speculating what it is like to be not of the world. But all the rest is very much of the world. Now this we must see, you know. And as I said a little earlier, when we really see, we naturally do. There is no difficulty in doing. When we really see, supposing you want to buy something, let us say you go down Oxford Street or whatever it is, and you look at the shops, and you look at this shop window and that shop window and the others, and you look with a critical eye. And then suddenly you see, that's it. That's the coat I need, or whatever it is. Yeah, finished. You've seen. And the seeing is accompanied by the action. Now, don't let the brain immediately start raising up all sorts of buts and ifs and ands. Just see the reality of it, the sense of it. It's the same with the religious life. Now, when that happens, a real magic takes place. Purification proceeds with almost an alarming speed. It just happens. You are so interested in it. You so care for it that it happens. The real asceticism then can be practiced. And as I have said over and over again, the real asceticism is simply this, that what you see as being unnecessary for fulfillment is naturally and easily put aside. It just falls off you. Then there is no conflict within about it. You may have to exercise considerable strength to push it out. That is quite true. But there's no conflict about it. This is the difference. Conflict arises because of uncertainty, because of contrary desires, irreconcilable desires, because of the futile, pathetic, stupid attempt to strike a compromise, where there can be no compromise, obviously. Supposing you're going to meet your best beloved and you look at yourself in the mirror for the last time and you see a great big smut upon your cheek, are you going to leave it there? Or are you going to just wash it off? Of course you'll wash it off. No question about it. The spiritual life is not very different from that. There's an of course-ness about it. And the power and the strength comes. Then what happens? When all these thoughts and plannings and intentions and memories and all the rest of it, all the dirt is out, this, the person, is cleansed, is pure. He is the temple of the Holy One. And the Holy One comes and resides in that temple. You see? And you don't know that that is the case. You are unself-conscious of it. The reality is there, but you don't know. It is a little bit like this. Whilst one is being born, there's a terrific struggle the mother goes through. And when the little one is born, that little one is the source of infinite satisfaction to the mother. But the little one doesn't know it, that he is the source of satisfaction. And this is joy which you can never grasp, which you will not grasp and hold. What I mean is you won't crave for it. Unfortunately, it's the mother who craves for the repetition of it. And you see, our joy becomes like the joy of the little one. It doesn't know that it has been the source of joy. The Holy One doesn't know that he's the source of joy, that he's a source of benediction. Now, I have spoken in the early part of this year about akasha, the word akasha, mind space, pure mind energy, dimensionless, formless, incomprehensible, with which I can have no dealings, but which completely and totally deals unto me and through me. I can say yea or nay to it. I can say nay because of the kind of life I live, of the world. Then I am saying nay to that, transcendent to that divine energy. If I care, if I am religious in the true sense, the simple sense, then I am saying yea to that energy. Now that energy is overwhelming. It makes or breaks. Therefore this has to be purified. If this is not a pure vessel, that energy breaks. You know how it is put in the theistic religions. God, the giver of life. It is God also who pronounces sentence of death and sends his agent, the devil, to take you away. Who came and fetched Don Juan, finally? Who took him down into hell? Very significant story, isn't it? I know there are various interpretations of Don Juan, that he was seeking the impossibly perfect love and so forth and so forth. All right, that's the generous interpretation. The fact is that he played the fool with lots of women, and no nonsense about it. He certainly was a lecherer on the way to finding the perfect beloved. But not a very successful technique to find the perfect beloved. Trying to have your cake and eat it. To enjoy the best of both worlds. Beware. It cannot be done. But it's astonishing how we find earnest people, sincere people, making this mistake over and over again. Have we not seen in our own lives, from our young days up till now, something comes along, something attractive to the senses, and we say, oh well, never mind, I'll indulge this time, after that, no. I shall be the perfect saint. Never again afterwards. When a few hours have passed, that little demon has become stronger because he has been fed, and he rises up and says, how now? Just another little nibble, you see? And you fall again. Let's have no nonsense about it. So you see, the purity is absolutely essential. This energy is a tremendous thing. Meditation and techniques of meditation are ways and means of releasing that energy. And in this case, by meditation, I don't mean merely in the religious sense. If you're a mathematician, a physicist, when you're concentrating, making your new discoveries through the application of your mathematical knowledge, you are releasing energies, aren't you? When Einstein presented his fundamental equation E equals mc squared, one of the children of that equation was the atomic bomb, was it not? See? We say the mathematician, the scientist, is perfectly pure-minded, It's a perfectly pure-minded search for truth. When the devil searches for truth, I'm using the extreme example, of course, what happens? He organizes it most successfully in order to tie us to this hell of being of the world. Now you see the wisdom of the old folks who had an esoteric aspect and an exoteric aspect. First of all, the purification. Simple discipline of purification. Don't ask stupid questions about all the deep things. What does God have for breakfast None of all that. You'll know all about it when you have breakfast with God or dine with God. You'll know all about it. First, this. Then, when you're ready, and you have the right kind of hunger and the right kind of approach to this divine host, then the divine feast will be there for you. But not till then. Today we can't do that. Things get thrown open, openly. With printing and modern communication and all the rest of it, the day of esotericism is over. And there are many other quite important reasons, psychological and historical and so forth. The day of esotericism as such is over. Therefore, our responsibility becomes ever so much greater. So now, meditation will be there when the purification has been realized. And when the purification is there, there'll be freedom from all self-orientedness, freedom from all isolative self-consciousness, freedom from craving, from grasping, freedom from fear, freedom from self-protection, freedom from resentment, from illusions and delusions. In that state, what begins as the practice of the Brahma Viharas we heard of at our last meeting here on Saturday becomes a stupendous, a transcendent reality. You know what the Brahma Viharas are, the divine abidings. And what are these divine abidings? The Buddha is asked, what is the way to union with Brahma, the Father God? What is the way to union? And the Buddha says, when a bhikkhu, that is a monk, when a monk fills one quarter with loving kindness, without holding anything back, giving all in loving kindness to everything, and he spreads that through all the four quarters, all the six quarters, some would like to say, and so forth, whatever they may be, you see, then he is in union with Brahma, the Father God. And the Buddha calls Brahma, the Father God, Sanang Kumara. Sanang, the everlasting, Kumara, youth. The everlasting youth who is the virgin youth, although he is the Father God. It's a very interesting presentation. The freshness of the creative energy and power is with that person who can do that. But if I start in the ordinary way, I as I am, with my taints, greed, hate, delusion and so forth, and with my tainted consciousness, what do I do when I go through the words? There are beautiful words which Harold read last time. Everyone in the world, my fathers and mothers. What a wonderful significance to it. Any human being can have only one father and mother. Neither the law, nor social custom, nor people's conceptions can change the unalterable absolute fact of nature that a human being has only this father and this mother. And that relationship is a living and an unassailable relationship, the parent-child relationship. You see? My fathers and mothers, all human beings. It's a wonderful way of understanding it. And to them you spread loving kindness. Now when one says it, one says so many words, which certainly can be associated with a genuine feeling inside, a pure feeling. But how far does that go? That rests with oneself, doesn't it? It goes a certain distance. It will affect one's own nature in the right direction, helping that person to become more and more harmless. This is the great thing. More and more harmless. Helping him to become less and less self-centered, up to a point. But the energy liberated will also intensify the other aspect of me, the destructive aspect, the harmful aspect, because it is I who practice these things in my present state, who, when the provocation is sufficiently strong, will explode with greater destructiveness than ever. This is the very subtle, difficult psychological problem with which the aspirant to the spiritual life is subject. It's a very difficult problem. Hence the remarkable wisdom of the great spiritual teachers, always to present the task as getting free of what is evil, what is wrong. And the rest is naturally good. The first chapter of Genesis suggests this very strongly. God said this, that, and the other, and every time he said something, it was. And God saw it was good. You get it now? The all good utilizes this akashic power, which is the real meaning of thought power, which I don't know anything about, which we human beings know nothing about really. This is thought power, this creative power. He utilizes that. He says the word. This is how we can express it, we humans can express it. Obviously he didn't say it in Hebrew or Chinese or Sanskrit or any other, or even English. You see? God said, and it was, and God saw that it was good, the absolute good. But this is a prefiguration of the possibility that lies within us, because who wrote Genesis but a man? A man who had realized these truths and saw them. Now, any religious technique is a power which intensifies. If there are conflicting elements present, it intensifies the conflict. This is what we have to be careful about. On the positive side, this is why if we are mindful all the time and see the evil as it crops up, just see it. Don't indulge it, don't fight against it. You'll get tired of hearing me repeat this 1,000 times. Don't fight it, don't indulge it. Just see, keep on seeing. Don't push it out of your consciousness. See the thing in its wholeness. And if you keep on seeing like this, seeing it like that, that whole psychical energy or problem or whatever it is undergoes a transformation and becomes a tower of strength in you. It becomes soul strength, which is virtue. You see how to become virtuous? Not by saying, I'm going to become loving, I'm going to become faithful and all the rest of it. You can't do anything of the sort, because you will make conceptions, and all my conceptions are tainted conceptions. They are false conceptions. They are misconceptions. They hold the seeds of death, conflict and death in them. But this way, you just pay attention to the thing without wanting anything one way or the other. And the power which is Akasha does the needful. This is how one is a benediction to the world in which one lives. Don't think one has to wait till one is the perfected holy one to do it, because most of us will wait in vain for that lovely day. You see? But here and now, seeing this, living in the world but not of the world at all, that way one is, in one's own way, a source of benediction. There is not only the sun in the heavens which gives us this light, there are also the myriads of lovely twinkling stars, and some which are invisible even. Quite nice to be an invisible star. See it and be happy. Be happy. Happiness which is not born, which doesn't die, which cannot be taken away, which cannot be grasped, which cannot be spoiled. If you don't seek happiness, but just see truth, see the reality that this operation of the pleasure drive, the objects of sense, and the misuse of the senses is the origin of our evil. When you really see that, this very thing gets transformed. And that is the thing that the scriptural writings do not sufficiently bring out. They don't bring out the transformation of that which is evil. And so the religious heritage which we have from ancient times has certain inadequate formulations. Fight the good fight business. There's nothing to fight. You're fighting your own self. That's all. You see? But see it like that and be happy inside. The calmness which is happiness. Because unless you are happy, you cannot be good. And unless you are good, you cannot be happy. And if you are good, happy, then the whole world is affected by that. And you are a source of benediction to the world.